My morning commute often sounds something like this.
We are delayed because of train traffic ahead of us. We apologize for any inconvenience.
We are delayed because of signal problems.
Sick passenger.
Police activity.
Track fire.
Debris on the tracks.
Electrical problems.
All trains are just messed up.
I catch the 7 train from Queens into Manhattan, which has been undergoing renovation and repairs for years. And in the same amount of time that I've seen luxury skyscrapers rise in Long Island City, the rickety old switches on the outdoor tracks of the 7 train still need tweaking multiple times a year and not including other expansions and repairs. I mean, I've watched a 20-minute subway ride turn into a sweaty and frustrating hour and a half of misery.
If China were fixing the 7 train in New York, they could get it done faster.
Fixing the 7th train in the United States of America should take between 5 and 7 years, and it's no surprise that it takes that long.
In China, that speed comes at the cost of safety and economic viability.
And the reason it takes that long are because of environmental regulations, permitting, and labor costs and requirements.
Today, we unpack America's infrastructure woes, from our bridges and tunnels and public transit and airports. America's infrastructure needs a serious makeover. Is it time to be thinking more like China? I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's not just us here in New York City. It's all part of a bigger American problem. Our infrastructure is in really bad shape, and it impacts different communities in different ways. Now, the president is proposing $1.5 trillion in infrastructure spending, except $200 billion of that is coming from Congress to fix roads and highways and bridges. But another $1.3 trillion in improvements will be needed from the private sector. For the president, there's just too much red tape when it comes to building new projects and fixing the ones that are breaking. He says he wants speed and efficiency.
We're going to make our infrastructure modernized, and we're really way behind schedule. We're way behind other countries. We always led the way for many, many years. Then, a number of decades ago, it slowed down, and over the last 8 years and 15 years, to be honest, it's come to a halt.
The president likes countries that get projects done quickly. Countries like China, whose infrastructure advances he once called, quote, incredible. A video that went viral a couple of weeks ago from China had 1,500 workers replace a stretch of track in just 8.5 hours. I cannot imagine what those workers would do with my 7 train problem. Today, we'll compare China and the United States when it comes to infrastructure and think about what can actually push the U.S. ahead toward getting our own infrastructure back on track. I have 2 guests with me that might be able to help.
My name is John Hillman. I'm the director of the Reconnecting Asia Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
And I'm Otis Rowley. I'm the regional director for North America at 100 Brazilian Cities and Rockefeller Foundation.
So I think there are a few main differences. And while it's, I think, always a risk to overgeneralize, I think we can say safely that one of the big differences is financing. And that's what the U.S. is beginning to have a debate on right now. In Asia, including in China, the ratio of public to private investment is usually 3 to 1 or higher. In Europe, it's like 1 to 2. So it's, you know, much less. And the Trump administration has just proposed a ratio of public to private spending of about 1 to 6.5. And so from the very beginning of this process, which is paying for it, China has a lot of money to put on the table.
John is spot on. You can't just look at the financing, though. It is a major issue, but it's also issues around permitting, environmental review, labor costs. All of these things, they are excuses and issues that in Asia are not necessarily a hindrance to the construction of infrastructure projects.
So some of these things that you mentioned, Otis, are important, right? We want to make sure there are environmental protections. We want to make sure that workers are protected. But it seems to be coming at a cost of those of us who actually need to use these services.
Yeah, and that's why I said excuses and not reasons. The reality is, fortunately, here in the United States and in much of the Western world, there's a great appreciation for the environment. And there's a recognition that in building these infrastructure projects, you need to do so in a way that still protects the environment and ensures the health and safety of the citizens in and around the project that is to be built. And so I said excuses because the review process, the regulations around what is necessary is often overly laborious and overly difficult, and it creates time horizons that make projects that should take much less time than they take occur. And so I also recognize when I talk about the labor issues, and John can talk about this obviously in much more detail, but there are labor protections here that don't exist in China, and we want those protections to exist. American citizens and their rights should be protected. But there are also an overabundance of regulations around some of these labor issues that I think really extends some of the infrastructure project time horizons.
And John, in terms of that issue, the labor issue, what are we missing when we watch these viral videos of Chinese workers putting together, you know, in 8 hours, this, you know, a subway station or whatever? Like, what are we missing there? Are we missing the fact that those folks are probably underpaid or not protected workers?
Well, you know, we used to do this in the United States. Next year is going to be the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railway. And, you know, 150 years ago, rail executives would be betting with each other who could build the most track in a day. And that was due to they had all of the land rights worked out very easily. They had abundant sources of cheap labor. But I also think that they, with that speed, they also sacrificed safety, which is a whole, you know, another set of issues beyond the social environmental safeguards.
So let's look at what the president's plan is now. And it sounds like there is, and I'm curious, Otis, what you think, is there the potential here to favor certain cities or certain projects over others because of this emphasis on getting private investment?
Well, it's difficult for me to call it a plan, because when you look at the infrastructure proposals that he's laying out, it's $200 billion over 20 years of quote-unquote new federal investment, but it's not really new investment. And so you have really shifting funds from existing federal programs towards this infrastructure investment, and is far below what would be necessary for any state or city to do the infrastructure work that is necessary to really change the current landscape in the U.S. I think it's also problematic because there's a major shift in terms of regulation or deregulation towards really creating more tolls on existing highways and byways in a way that's really going to create more inequity and less ability for those individuals within the United States of low income, moderate income, to get to those jobs and opportunities that are necessary to achieve the American dream.
John, any thoughts on that?
I think, as I was alluding to earlier, I am a little bit skeptical that only $200 billion of public financing is going to be able to mobilize 6.5-fold of that. I do think that the U.S. does have one strength that China does not have, at least one, and that's that we do have access to large amounts of institutional capital. And, you know, there are large pension funds and other investors who I think would like to be involved in projects that are going to generate a return for them.
Is there any fear of expanding too quickly?
I don't think we have the risk of going too fast in the United States. But I do think there's a happy medium. Like, I know Singapore, which is one of our 100 resilient cities at the Rockefeller Foundation, is, I think, doing it the right way, that they're building at the right pace and doing it with the degree of environmental and human sensitivity where they are a model, I think, in Asia. And I think there is a lot that we can learn from them in terms of how they're doing infrastructure investment, both in terms of how they're financing it, but also how they design it and build it out.
And when I think about infrastructure, again, I think about my terrible commute and not just me. I mean, New Yorkers are pretty fed up about how difficult the public transportation system has gotten here in the city. But there are also other places in the United States. You mentioned, you know, we talked about Flint, Michigan, for example, that still does not have clean water. There are cities that have still been impacted by hurricane, disasters. We have the entire, you know, island of Puerto Rico that still needs basic infrastructure. And I'm not sure if this plan is going to try and address those types of issues. Those tend to be folks that may, you know, that are probably more low income. Maybe they're not going to be the focus of some of this infrastructure money.
I completely agree. This plan, this proposal that's been put out by the Trump administration, doesn't necessarily address those serious issues of lack of investment, particularly when you're talking about $20 billion a year over the next 20 years. It's just not enough resources. We fundamentally do believe in public-private partnerships. It is there are a lot of sound principles, and there's a lot of capital that's available where we can do these investments in a way that makes sense. But what is being proposed here is not realistic in terms of when you look at the amount of investments that's necessary and the lack of resources at the local and state level to get this work done. And I do believe that there's a real desire. It's not a blue desire or a red desire. There's an American desire to get this done. And I'm excited about some of the various proposals that we're seeing in Congress. I'm hoping that at the very least, President Trump's proposal helps to motivate Congress and the nation to have a very serious conversation about what we can do and how we can do it in a resilient way.
John, I'm wondering, is there anything that the United States, or any tips that the United States can take from China, from the way that they approach infrastructure?
Sure. So I think what you're getting at is, you know, the state of America's infrastructure, it has sort of wide-ranging implications, not only for cities and towns, but it is a national issue. And I think China really made it a national priority for their development. And so I think that the U.S., if it really does, you know, want to compete in the 21st century, I think this has to be a top national priority.
I also believe it's not just a national economic development kind of priority, but it's a national security priority as well. If you think about infrastructure beyond just transit and rail and roads, but the water system, just the overall infrastructure of this nation is so deteriorating that it is a national security issue. And if America could shift in terms of prioritizing this in a real way, as we once did as a nation, it could have great benefits to us overall.
Well, as someone who uses the system regularly, I can tell you all the systems, we need some serious help. John and Otis, thank you so much for being with us today on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
As the Trump administration sets its sight on U.S. infrastructure, we want to know what infrastructure projects outside the U.S. have impressed you most.
It's Sherry from Miami. The most impressive infrastructure that I've ever seen is the Sydney Harbor Bridge. It is truly magnificent and breathtaking.
This is Ben from Seattle, Washington. I just finished a research paper, actually a literature review, on the progress that Vancouver, BC is making in transitioning to a 100% carbon neutral city. Their plan is to have a 100% electric-only transportation system, both public and private, by 2050.
My name's Leanne. I'm calling from Olympia, Washington. In my opinion, mass transit in developed nations is truly amazing. I host international workers with some regularity, and they're always astounded that I have to drive so far to pick them up at a bus or a train station.
This is Arvind here from Renton, Washington. I think the subway train service in London is amazing. Similarly, trains in Europe are very convenient and well-connected. I'll even say that India has a more well-connected train network than the U.S.
Guy Vanderleck, Wilmington, Delaware. I'd like to see more affordable broadband service across the United States. Where I live in suburban northern Delaware, I only have one source of high-speed internet. And when you've got a monopoly, you pay a lot.
Tell us what bridges, roads, tunnels have surprised or impressed you outside of the U.S. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Tanzina Vega.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.